Let's all turn to Nehemiah chapter 13. The number 400. What is significant about the number 400, at least where this class is concerned? If you know the number 400, you have a handle on the history of the Israelite nation. If you can just remember the number 400, Old Testament history happened in 400 year cycles. Call of Abraham, approximately 1800 BC. 400 years later, Moses brings the Israelites out of Egypt, and then you have the period of the judges. 1000 BC, the beginning of the monarchy, and then 400 years later, the fall of the Judean kingdom and the Babylonian captivity. So it rounds out to 400 year cycles, and like we say, if you can remember that number, you have Old Testament history. These are the dates that we are currently interested in. 586, the Babylonians burned Jerusalem, and they took them into captivity. Now, we come down here to 458, the return of Ezra, and then 445, Nehemiah rebuilds the walls. We have been looking at this in terms of restoration. We've kind of thrown that word out as something to think about in the last part of Nehemiah. And in thinking about what really needed to be restored, we've kind of looked at this chart. Ezekiel chapter 37, the vision of the dry bones. God was going to bring them back to their land, going to give them a sanctuary, and David their king would reign over them. So we have land, we have a temple, and we have the great king who is coming. When we look at Nehemiah, they're back in their land, they rebuilt the temple, but the king has not yet arrived. Now, when we think about restoration, one of the major points that we kind of like to drill, and when we get to the end, we're going to make a little chart of things to remember. If we think about restoration, one of the most important points to remember is the idea that if you have left God behind, like the Feast of Booths, if you left it behind 1,000 years ago, do you still need to go back and do it the way it was written? That is a key point. When man leaves God behind, even if he did it 1,000 years ago, if he hadn't done it right since the days of Joshua, he needs to go back, pick it up, and do it the way that God said. And we, you know, use that chart to kind of relate it to ourselves. Now, in closing out the book, final picture. We come to chapters 9 through 13. Now, in chapter 9, it starts out with just a beautiful picture of the graciousness of God and how well God treated the nation. God is just. And since God has been so good to us and God is so just, we are signing our names and we are going to agree to do certain things. Now, as they sign the document, we find out that what looks like just an endless number of names and details, we find out when we kind of step back and look at each chapter and just really think about what we are looking at, we see some things in the final picture that are tremendously important when we talk about restoration. In chapter 10, when they sign their name, they sign their name to maintain the temple. We're going to do what it takes. We're going to take up a collection. We're going to bring in the wood. We're going to see to it that the temple of God is maintained. Is it possible for them to really move forward without maintaining that temple? Chapter 10, they're going to maintain Jerusalem. They're going to pick people to live there because Jerusalem is a symbol and there needs to be somebody living in that city. So they are going to commit to maintain the temple. They're going to commit to maintain Jerusalem. In the 12th chapter, they are going to have a legitimate priesthood. The requirements to be a priest are going to be met. And if we were going a simple parallel, back then, they're talking about the registry. today, if we talk about the priesthood, who are the priests of God today? Christians. He has made you a kingdom of priests. Are there requirements for a priesthood? Can anybody be a priest? Just anybody? Or are there requirements? You can't be a priest unless you're called. How is one called? By the gospel. You know, one thing to think about if we're talking about gospel obedience, priesthood, you had to meet the requirements or you weren't a priest. Today we talk about a priesthood. If you don't meet the requirements, you're not a priest. And that's why looking at what the scripture actually says regarding gospel obedience is a very important thing to do. So we're going to maintain the temple. We're going to maintain Jerusalem. We're going to have a legitimate priesthood. And then in the 13th chapter, something a little bit different. But we find out in chapter 13, there's going to be vigilance in details. We're going to pay attention to what's actually happening. Now, just because you get big things in place, does that mean they'll always stay in place? The temple, Jerusalem, the priesthood, big things. But you find out by hard experience that if you are not vigilant in details, what happens? Falls apart. And does it take very long? You're going to find out right here it doesn't take very long. That's one of the messages of the 13th chapter, the need for continued diligence. Now, excuse me. In verses 1 through 9 of chapter 13, the first example of vigilance in detail, it concerns Ammonites and Moabites and coming into the assembly of God. Now, what was the big incident that kind of brought that to a head? There's an example in verses 4 through 9. Tobiah, the Ammonite. What had Eliashib the priest done for him? Cleaned out a storeroom and made him a chamber or a room at the temple. So we have an Ammonite dignitary actually living in the temple of God. And you just can't do that. And Nehemiah let him know that you just can't do that. He simply perverted the temple of God to his own purpose. And that just was not the right thing to do. Now, as we pick up, let's go back to chapter 13. And let's notice something in the 6th verse. Question becomes, they're getting everything in order. How is it that some of this stuff can kind of all of a sudden become problematical? In verse 6, but during all this time, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave of the king. All these things that are kind of going south on them take place when? Nehemiah had to take a trip back and go see the king. In chapter 2 and verse 1, we find that the whole process with Nehemiah started in what year of Artaxerxes? Chapter 2 and verse 1. 20th year of Artaxerxes. In chapter 5 and verse 14. Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. He comes back in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, and he's governor for how long? 12 years. Now, if he got there in 445, that brings us down to what year? Take 12 off of 445 B.C., 433 B.C. We're creeping up on 400. All right, so he's been governor for 12 years, rather. Now we come back here to the 13th chapter, and at the end of the 12th year, who did he have to go visit? Had to go back to the king. Can't prove this, but it kind of makes it appear like he originally determined it was going to be a 12-year period there. And the period was up, so he had to go see the king, but he evidently managed to convince the king of what? I need to go back to Jerusalem. So the king allows him to go back to Jerusalem, gave him an extension. And what we found out is that when Nehemiah left, the expression, while the cat's away, the mice will play, that's exactly what happened. Now, in verses 10 through 14, Jimmy, would you read that, please? Do you have that? Nehemiah 13, verses 10 through 14. Okay, in verses 10 through 14, we find that while Nehemiah was gone, they hadn't bothered to do what? Tithe, and the purpose of the tithe was what? We're not going to pay the Levites. We're not going to pay the tithe. Can you see any connection between this and this? This storeroom they cleared out for Tobiah, what were they keeping in it? Stuff for the Levites. Now, I don't know how big a crimp that put in things, but all of a sudden, we're not paying the Levites anymore. That kind of goes by the wayside. In the 10th verse, what had the Levites been forced to do? Go home, go to work. I mean, you got to eat somehow. So if you're not going to pay the Levites are going to have to support themselves. And in the 13th verse, finally, when Nehemiah comes back, they get somebody who is reliable. Now, make a little observation. When you divert resources from the real work of God, then the real work of God is going to suffer. I mean, you take this. I mean, this was supposed to be used for the support of the Levites. You divert that to your own secular purpose, then the real work of God suffers. That is something that is worth remembering. You might have present-day applications. Now, let's look at verses 15 through 22. Excuse me. Yeah, thank you. You know, I've got cough drops laying on the floor in my office. I don't know how they got there. Jason Lee, now, would you read that, please?
What is this?
through 22. Okay. So we got issues with perversion of the purpose of the temple, problems with paying the Levites. Now we're talking about problems with observance of the Sabbath, and that was always big in the Old Testament. In the 15th verse, in those days I saw some in Judah who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath. They're working. Men of Tyre are coming and doing what? You know, they want to buy and sell on the Sabbath day. He tried to warn them off. But when it was obvious they weren't going to be warned off, what did he threaten them with? So we are going to use force. Then I warned them and said to them, why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you. He's serious. You know, Nehemiah walks into the situation, pardon me for putting it this way, in his personal life, do you think that you would call Nehemiah just a hardcore, mean, tough guy? You ever get that impression? I don't. But are there times when somebody has to be hard-nosed when something has to get done? Okay, he's getting hard-nosed. When things start going in the wrong direction, they're making so much effort to go in the right direction, and when things start going in a bad direction, all of a sudden you got a guy here that cleans out that room, says you're going to pay the Levites, and if you come here on the Sabbath, you know, I'm going to send the troops out. You know, he is going to make certain that this goes in the right direction. And then in verses 23 through 30. All right, let's read that. Pardon me. Brian Jensen, would you read that? Yes. Horror night. Okay, so the last problem we come across is what? Problems regarding? Okay, intermarriage, or we could have just said marriage problems. That says intermarriage, whether or not you can read it. I thought we'd solved all of that. Hadn't we just gone over that in Ezra, the 10th chapter? How long ago was that? Approximately how many years? Ezra got there 458. Nehemiah gets there 445. This is 12 years later. Generation? Are we talking a generation? How long does it take for things to go south and to back up the clock again? If you look in Judges, it usually takes about a generation. So the problem we thought we had solved in Ezra, the 10th chapter, all of a sudden Nehemiah comes and Ezra's still around. And yet we're coming back to that same old problem. How can this be? Who can tell me what 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 says? If I say in unison, your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion. Be sober, be vigilant. Your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now, if we think about enemies, and there's a lot of enemies in Ezra and Nehemiah, or if we think about error, again, something we've been trying to emphasize, just because you win the battle and gain control of the field, does that mean the enemies just pack up and go away? Or are they always going to be there? Okay. Everybody, think of some Old Testament and New Testament examples of persistent error. Examples of the people of God winning a battle, thinking the enemy is vanquished, and lo and behold, the enemy's back again. Can you think of any? Bob. Peter siding with the Gentiles, against the Gentiles. Peter's kind of a living testimony of how often the devil will come back. You know, as Jesus said, Satan has desired to have you that he might sift you as wheat. King Ahab in the Old Testament, were there times when you read the story of Ahab where you think, oh, he got it, and he's going to be okay now? And then the next story comes around, and what's Ahab doing? Same thing he was doing before. At the temptation of Jesus, the devil came and tempted him and departed for a season, departed for a while. There is one thing about error. It is persistent. It keeps coming back. If we talk about restoration, one point we would make about it is that it is a constant, ongoing effort. And it has to be a constant, ongoing effort because there are people who don't want it. They don't want it to happen. In these days, in the days of Nehemiah, were there enemies that just did not want to see a restoration of what was right? If we bring it back to this, intermarriage, they'd solved that problem less than 20 years previously. Now you blink and here's the problem again. If you look at verses 23 through 25, what's the problem with these kids? You could put it this way, they're more pagan than Jewish. That's the problem that you're looking at. They're raising a generation of kids that are more pagan than Jewish. If you look at the 26th verse, if you talk about verse 25. What did Nehemiah do to these guys? He slapped them around a little bit and pulled their hair. Now that is really getting with it. That is teaching somebody the error of their ways. And the object lesson he pointed to was who? Solomon. God loved him, but he fell. And in the 28th verse, even one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat. One of the priests had actually married Sanballat's daughter. And if you look in Leviticus 21, priests were restricted as to who they could and could not marry. So we got some things going on here that are just... He came back and found that we've gone right back into this. Now, we emphasize again, if we talk about restoration, restoration takes vigilance. And if you look at what we're looking at here, right now we're just doing some generalization and thinking about some problems. Problems that usually get in the way when people are trying to restore what God wants. If you generalize, making room for an Ammonite priest and not paying the Levites, you're really kind of perverting. You're perverting God's service into, essentially, into whatever you want it to be. I mean, here's the temple. Here's what it's for. We're going to use it for whatever we want to use it for. Perverting God's service into what I want it to be. The Sabbath. We look at the Sabbath, but the way that he talks about the Sabbath, the real issue with the Sabbath was commercial. You got people working on it, the wine press. You got people wanting to buy and sell on the Sabbath, and you shall not do that. Essentially, this is a money problem that we are talking about here. We're talking about greed. And when we get into the marriage deal, we're talking about morals and relationships. Now, if we say the real problems with restoration, perversion of God's stuff into our stuff, greed, morals and relationships, is it any different today? If you look at where the problems lie, if we talk about going back and doing things God's way, it's the same issues no matter what generation you happen to be living in. And these are the things that always will have to be watched. Now, on the screen, you can make a note of this if you want to. Just some ideas on restoration that are in the text that you can spend some time thinking about. Things that we can kind of relate to what we are comfortable talking about, what we've historically talked about. The first one, probably the single most important point, returning to the way it was written, even if you have to go back 1,000 years. That was from the Feast of Booths. The next point, the concept of generic authority, which is something, the right to choose a means to an end. If God wants something done, we can choose a means to do it. In chapter 10, verses 32 through 35, they had to figure out a way to get the wood to burn the sacrifices and come up with enough money to support the temple. Concept of generic authority. Perversion of God, pardon me for using the word stuff, it's the term I'm comfortable with. The room in the temple. Perversion of God's stuff to personal use. And then finally, where restoration is concerned, you're going to have the same enemies in every generation. You know, these are going to be the things that have to be watched. Now, that is the last view of the Jewish nation in Old Testament history.